Thank you. My name is Howard, and I'm an alcoholic. My sobriety date is August the 4th, 1972. Bob is my sponsor, and he has a sponsor, and I sponsor people. I love Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'm honored to be invited to participate in this weekend. It's just been looking forward to it. You'd have thought that if I was looking forward to it this long, I would have done a better job of preparing what I was going to say. We'll see. I want to start out with Pat and I went to. We're doing things that we put off. We're retired and we're doing things that we put off, and while we still can do them. And we went to Yellowstone, and so I have an interest in buffaloes that I didn't have before. And there was one of my interests is the difference between a buffalo and a bison. Now, a buffalo is an American plains animal. A bison is what an Australian washes his face in. So, I have had several requests about the baby elephant story, but I'm going to tell it anyway. Pat and I were raised in this little community near Wichita, Kansas. And thank you. Thank you. We had free movies for the local farmers to come to our little community. And one of the movies included a short feature on training elephants in India. And they took the baby elephants out of the herd and started their training by tying a rope around the right front leg and snubbing them up to a tree. And they'd always been able to go free, so they're pulling and tugging and pulling and tugging and crying. It was sad. And we should do bring your handkerchief, because this is the saddest story I'm going to tell. And they come to believe that when that rope's tight, it's futile to pull. Then they went into the next phase of the training. But in each phase, they always reinforced this truth, that when the rope is tight, it's futile to pull. And at the end of the movie, this elephant is hauling tree trunks on his harness out of the forest for harvest. Big elephant, strong elephant. And at the lunchtime, when they wanted to hold him where they wanted to hold him, they drove a relatively short stake deep enough in the ground. They wrapped the rope around that stake and wrapped the rope around the big elephant's right front leg, and he could walk around, but when the rope got tight, he couldn't pull against the tight rope. Now, the rope didn't hold the elephant. The stake didn't hold the elephant. What held the elephant was the limiting belief they imposed on him all his life. And I came to Alcoholics Anonymous with approximately 753,902, approximately, baby elephant beliefs just like that. Stuff that was imposed on me when I was a kid, and I believed them. And not only did I believe them, they had to be true, even though I did not know I knew them. They had to be true for me to have a sense of well-being. And I had to make them true. I had to make them be true. And in this little community, now those of you that had the good fortune of being Lutherans or Catholics, I know that those two churches have catechisms where they have a very deliberate way of teaching you about Jesus and about God. I had wonderful, really wonderful ladies in the neighborhood who were housewives and who were farm wives, who had grown up reading the Bible, having their Bible stories, but each one would teach you something different. And one of the things that I ended up finding out as a baby elephant belief after I got to AA was I was taught that I was separate from God. God was an anthropomorphic being behind the pearly gates on the streets of gold, and it was always, help me God, you know, because God ain't here. God's up there. If they had told me God was in Kansas City, I wouldn't have known we were separate. And so I had that sense of separateness that Chuck C. talked about from as long as I can remember, and a sense of fear, very afraid. And not a hell of a lot happened to me back then to not make me more afraid. And I did learn also that if you're in trouble and if you're afraid, if you have behaved yourself, if you behave yourself the way God wants you to behave yourself, then you can beseech him in prayer for his help. The first time I remember beseeching God in prayer for his help was the day before harvest of the wheat harvest was supposed to start. It was Sunday morning. It would have started Sunday morning, but you don't cut wheat on Sunday. And we beseeched God for it not to rain until after harvest. There's a lot of reasons for that, but we do not want it to rain until after harvest. After harvest, we'll be praying for it to rain. But now, in case God don't know it, we want him to know, do not let it rain. Well, that day, it not only rained, it hailed, the wind blew, and destroyed all the wheat in Sumner County, Kansas. And while nobody pointed their finger at me, I knew whose fault it was. I knew who wasn't doing what you have to do for God to answer your prayer. Now, if you're 5 or 6 years old and you've assumed the entire responsibility for wiping out the Kansas wheat crop, what you have is an ego problem. The old effort to control things that I lack the power to control, and that I lack the power to get God's help in controlling. And I'll just tell you, there was nothing much going on at that time in my life that made me feel good. And so when I was 12 years old and I drank whiskey, this was the first time I felt good. And for the next, until I was 39, whiskey had a growing part of my life. It helped me feel good. I never felt good that I can remember without drinking whiskey. I mean, that good. You know, you can feel a little good. But I'm talking about if zero is the worst feeling you can have and 10 is the best. I'm running along about a 3 or a 2.5. My best feeling is a 3, which includes things are all right now, but something bad is going to happen. You know, I got this feeling of low grade alert about what the hell's going to happen next. And I drink whiskey and I go to an 8 or a 9. I'm telling you, there's a change. Now, Pat and I have been married 60 years, and during that 60 years, During that 60 years, she has gotten drunk one time. But all her life, she's run along about a 6 and a 7. She's very, very happy in school. Well, she was happy right up until after we got married. And she was a hell of a lot happier at that than I was. And I had everything to be happy about, but I could never get up there. And she went from a 7 to an 8 or a 9, and then she went to 2.5. And she comes out of the bathroom and says, "I don't know why you drink, but I'm never going to drink again. I don't know why you get drunk, but I'm never going to do that again." And she never has. She has never gotten drunk again. Now, I go from a 3 to an 8 back to a 2.5. I'm thinking, well, I don't want to go to a 2.5, but I'm sure as hell going to go to the 8 again, you know. And that's the way, that just was the way my life was. And it was the way her life was, except over any considerable period of time, it was getting worse, never better. And I did all the things that get us here. I did all the things that get us here. Got hopelessly in debt. Found equipment that others lost right before I found it. I was in big time trouble when I came to AA. But I did not know I was in trouble. I did not know. Now, my dad had gotten sober in AA on July the 6th, 1946. He came to AA. He stayed sober a little over a year. He had one weekend slip, and then he stayed sober and died sober at an AA meeting on March the 8th, 1951. So, at an AA meeting. He had a heart attack and passed away. And I was in the service then. And I never really got to experience what I found out about my dad later. But anyway, I did not come to Alcoholics Anonymous wanting to pray or meditate. That was a baby elephant belief that I had and had had for a long time. God, now I believed in God. I believed that God had the intelligence and power to create the universe. I had some vague notion of the precision of the finely tuned processes that are involved in the universe that you get from going to engineering school, and I believed that there had to be a God to have created that. But I did not believe he was around. I believe he created the universe the way he wanted the universe to be, and that the way you needed to live was to figure out how the universe works and then work that. And I'm telling you, how it worked for me was to drink whiskey first. And then to figure out. And I went, doing that, I went from a process analyst to an engineer to a senior engineer to an engineering manager and back to a senior engineer. And pretty good progression of time because I drank whiskey. If I had not drank whiskey, none of that would have happened, none of the promotions, because that was the way it worked for me. I was not anxious to stop drinking, yet I had to, at least until the equipment thing blew over. I came to AA on July the 26th, 1972. My sobriety date is August the 4th. I got drunk, stayed drunk, and I certainly proved to myself that I have a phenomenon of craving once I start to drink. I never believed I did. I believed that, and my sponsor said to me, there's a kind of alcoholic who once he starts to drink never tries to stop until he passes out. And if you don't try to stop, then the craving doesn't get an opportunity to set in. Perhaps that's why you never had a phenomenon of craving. Turns out he was right. So, in the first, my home group was an old group on the west side of Los Angeles in Culver City. My sponsor's sponsor was a guy named Frank Giroux, and he turns out to be the best friend I could have possibly had, or my family could have possibly had. And he helped me in everything. I've been sober, say, a couple of weeks, maybe three, and I come home and Pat's pissed off. I'm thinking, what the hell's the matter with her? She said if I'd stop drinking, everything would be all right. Now I've stopped drinking, and she's mad. Well, we have dinner, and I just go to the meeting early. And the lights aren't on, and Frank's fiddling with the lights, and the tables aren't getting put up. And I thought, well, I'll help him. And I'm telling you, these were the heaviest tables in captivity. And he was 62 years old, and I tried to lift that table, and I thought, how in the hell is that old man doing this? And I set the tables up, and the lights came on, and we made the coffee, and at the end of the meeting, Frank was making announcements, and Frank always said the same thing at the end of the announcements, but when he's making the announcement, he looks me right in the eye, and I think, he's going to thank me for setting up the tables and chairs. And I set up a little higher so that when he pointed to me, you would know it was me. And then he shifted from looking me in the eye and looked at the audience or at the rest of the group and said, I know God manifests everything I believe in, and I believe in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I thought, you son of a bitch, Afterward, we got the tables and chairs down, and Frank came up and said, I nearly messed it up for you, Howard. And I'm, how, what? And he said, I almost thanked you from the podium, and then I realized you would have wanted to set the tables and chairs up anonymously. The amazing thing is, I got it. That's the amazing thing about Alcoholics Anonymous is, if we just keep coming, we've been whipped enough. If you've been whipped enough, you just keep coming. And pretty soon you're setting up the tables and chairs and you're feeling good. I set the tables and chairs up with Frank for the rest of his life. And I went on 12-step calls. Anyway, when I was about a year sober, it just became important to me to get in your face and say, if you shared that you pray, I would, after the meeting, say, I don't pray. My God knew how to create the universe. He don't need any input from me about what to do. And you'd be surprised how many of you didn't care whether I prayed or not. I was amazed at how it was hard to start a fight here about... I said to Frank, well, I don't pray. God don't have ears. He's not an anthropomorphic being up in heaven. He's created the universe. He's out creating more of them. But this is just the way he wants it. And Frank said, well, I never learned to pray effectively until I learned to meditate. Now, what the hell kind of argument is that? What can you say other than, well, what is meditation? As soon as I learn about meditation, I'll discredit that, but I don't know anything else. This was on our, we had two meetings. One was a beginner's meeting early in the week, and the other was a speaker's meeting on Friday. And he told me, he said, the best thing I know to read about meditation is step 11 in the 12 and 12. And I said, I read that. And he said, well, read it again. Read it to see what the hell it's saying. And I did. Next Friday, he said, did you read that? And I said, yes, it's a St. Francis of Assisi prayer, which is just what I am not going to do. He said, is that all you got out of that? I said, Frank, that's all there is in there. And he said, why don't you come over tomorrow morning and we'll go over that. And we went over to his house and we had coffee and he said, now, prayer and meditation aren't really that important to the AA program. We only use prayer and meditation when we are doing each of the steps. Now, each of the steps require prayer and meditation. And then we only do it upon awakening. When planning your day, when facing indecision, we pause when agitated or doubtful and ask for direction. Better men than us are doing this constantly. We constantly remind ourselves we're no longer running the show. Thy will, not mine, be done. These are thoughts that must go with us constantly. And upon retiring at night. Except for that, it does not play a huge role. I'll spare you his taking me quickly through the steps. Where we admit we lack the power, where we come to believe in a power greater than ourselves. We decide to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God. In the fifth step, we begin to feel the nearness of our Creator. In the seventh step, we surrender our entire will and lives over the good and the bad, over to God's care. And in the ninth step, we suddenly realize that God is doing for us what we could not do for ourselves. And in the tenth step, we enter the world of the Spirit. Now, he said, if you're going to skip the 11th step, what the hell did you do the other stuff for? That prayer and meditation are the payoff of the success you've had with these other steps. Then we went kind of word by word through, and some of the words are on the 12 and 12, prayer and meditation are our principal means of being conscious of God's presence. The principal means. Would you want to skip that? You know, you may not think God is with you, but if you're going to be conscious of the fact there is a God, are you going to skip that? That God created the universe. If that's what you believe, you're going to give up your consciousness of that. And then a couple pages later, self-examination, meditation, and prayer, taken independent of each other, enrich your life immensely. But when these three things, self-examination, meditation, and prayer, are logically interrelated and interwoven, they form an unshakable foundation for life. Do you feel like you have an unshakable foundation for life? Well, it was a good morning that morning. He said, yes, we could do, and he said, now he does say the St. Francis of Assisi prayer, but I don't want you to do that. I know that you know what the big book says about the first step. I know that you know that. Our beginners meeting, they always went through the same stuff. Chuck Innes, if there was a newcomer there, Chuck Innes would talk about what the big book says, and you just learn it, you know. And he said, we will go through the first step. And he said, we'll call meditation, we will call it being conscious of what you want to be conscious of. Okay? Be aware of what you want to be aware of. And self-examination is when you are aware of what you want to be aware of, where you fit in that. And then we'll talk about prayer in a minute. And so we went through, now I look at my watch not to see what time it is, but to give those of you that are worried about it a sense of optimism. As far as I'm concerned, I invented that joke. It had been stolen from me for a little while, but God gave it back to me. So, let's just reenact this little thing and kind of be awake and be conscious. Let your meditation be conscious of what the big book describes about alcoholics, what they are, who they are, and alcoholism. Just follow along with me. If you're distracted by me standing here, close your eyes. But listen to the meaning of each word and phrase. Listen carefully. We call that meditation. Okay. Step one. We are powerless over alcohol. Our lives have become unmanageable. Doing it again. We admitted we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable. The big book tells us that alcoholics are men and women who have lost the ability to control their drinking. Looking at it at deeper meaning, the loss of control is characterized by an insane, obsessive belief each time we start to drink that somehow, some way, this time it's going to be different. This time I'm going to control and enjoy my drinking. But coupled with that insane obsession is a physical reaction which manifests itself in the phenomenon of craving for more. We are restless, irritable, and discontented until we can once again experience the sense of ease and comfort that comes from taking a few drinks. Drinks which our insane obsession convinces us we can take with impunity. And when we succumb, as we always did, and the phenomenon of craving develops, we go through the well-known stages of a spree, emerging remorseful with a firm resolve never to do that again. And we do it again and again and again. And over any considerable period of time, it gets worse. It never gets better, which leads in time to pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization. Now, if in being conscious of the meaning of that description of alcoholics and alcoholism, if you feel like that fits, your experience with drugs and alcohol, then you can fully concede to your innermost self that you're an alcoholic. That is the first step in recovery. We'll call that self-examination, and we'll call that meditation. Well, what about prayer? Well, if you sit quietly after you have conceded to your innermost self you're an alcoholic, and Frank was aware of how my life had changed. Pat had said she was going to stay with me, and I got promoted. I took the equipment back. I'm telling you, all those things are tall poles in the tent of a newcomer's life. And the first time through the steps, it's about what you get to wipe out are the tall poles in the tent. But Frank knew that. And he said, just sit quietly and be open to how your life has changed since you stopped drinking. And he said, if you get a good feeling from the changes, which he said in defining gratitude, it is taking away bad things from your life and adding good things to your life, you get this feeling of goodness. That's called gratitude. Now, he said, thank you, God, would be a prayer. But I don't want you to do that. He said, this is not a cup, and it doesn't have coffee in it. This is not a lectern. This is not a table, and that's not a chair. Because cup, lectern, table, and chair are words. These things aren't words, they're what they are. Thank you, God, are good words, but they're words. If you feel gratitude, just let the feeling of gratitude be your prayer. Let that be your prayer, and from time to time, you will experience while you're doing that a good feeling coming up your body and leaving goosebumps. He said, that will be my God saying, I felt your gratitude and you're welcome. And so we went off on prayer and meditation. And I just make up page numbers in the book. And nobody ever checked except Caroline. I gave him the wrong page numbers for what I wanted him to read, but I told him what it was, and he knew the page number. But anyway, on page 88, it says, we are an undisciplined lot, and we let God discipline us in this simple way we just described. It works. It really does. That's the smallest paragraph in the book. If they would have left it the way it is in the manual, the script, which is, it works, it really does, try it. I think that would have still been the shortest paragraph and more powerful, because that's, it does work, try it. Frank had also made it clear to me, because I had told him why I didn't like religion. There was a bunch of reasons, but one of them was, in religion, they require me to will myself to intellectually assent that something is true without any chance in this lifetime of validating it. No big deal. But I could never do that comfortably. But I did it. Why would I do it? Why did I do it? Because if I don't, I'm going to hell forever. Well, hell, I'm doing it. Believe me, I'm doing it. Except I couldn't make it work. And so I, just in favor of the whiskey worked, I abandoned any efforts to make that work. I came here, and you got to unlearn. Boy, when they say let go of your old ideas, that's the hardest thing in the world, because those are baby elephant beliefs. I'm not even going to say what I think would be funny to say now. I did the meditation, and I would feel good, I would feel grateful, and then I'd do it the next day. And then life would be good. And so I would shut the snooze alarm on, and I wouldn't get up this morning to meditate and pray. And then I wouldn't get up and wouldn't get up and wouldn't get up and didn't even know I wasn't getting up. And I'd talk to Frank or somebody, and pretty soon he'd say, well, how's your meditation? Son of a gun, I haven't been meditating. Well, I'm going to meditate. And I would, and pretty soon I'm out of the corner again, and then I'm back in the corner. I'm trying to work the steps. I've gone through the steps, and I've gone through them again. I had first started out, I wasn't going to work any steps. And old Leo, Clancy would remember Leo H., he was a two-stepper. Well, actually a three-stepper. He worked the first step, the 12th, and the 13th. But but the two steps seemed to me like that was a good way to go. And I tried that. And then it didn't work real good. So then I decided I'd throw the 10th in. And I tell you, I was diligent about my efforts to work the 10th step. And I know that in the big book it says we look for when we're going to be when selfishness, dishonesty, anger, or fear start up, we immediately ask God to take those away. You know how many times I was able to do that in the first several years of my sobriety? Not one time. When I get mad, there's no stopping it. And when I'm afraid, I just have anxiety. And I want my way. I love her. That's why I want my way, is because I know that I'm right about what we should be doing. And if she would just buy into it and do that, she would be happy. I would be happy. Everything would be wonderful. Well, it ain't working. And so I'm angry and I hear a guy that Clancy mentioned Bob mentioned last night. He was one of Sybil's husbands. He was her last husband. His name was Bob Corwin. And he was talking about being in prison. He had an interesting prison story in that he was living in this hotel and got drunk in their bar and went to the cashier and robbed it. Held a gun in their face. It was armed robbery. Give me the money. They all, Bob, go, give me the money. They gave him the money. He went up to his room, passed out. And believe it or not, the Los Angeles cops captured him right there. So he's up sharing this story, which is funny. And then he says, but the good thing about this, he said, the wonderful thing about it was in prison, I learned to love. And he said, I even learned not to swear because love does not behave itself unseemly. And I said, that's Shakespeare. Maybe it's in the big book. I'll ask him. And afterwards, I was the last guy in line, kept being the last so that I could talk to him. And I said, did that line, love does not behave itself unseemly, does that come from Shakespeare or the big book? He said, no, that comes from the big, big book. We ain't getting involved in that. And then he saw this and he said, well, it wasn't really the Bible that we studied. It was a book written by Henry Drummond called The Greatest Thing in the World. And it's an essay, a series of essays on 1 Corinthians 13th chapter, on the love poem written by St. Paul. But he said it's Drummond that we were reading. And I went home and said, Pat, I want you to get me a book. And she said, you own that book. You have that. My mother had left it to me with instructions to give it to Howard. I don't know why she thought I should be singled out for this. But I opened it, I guess, at the time, and I saw it was Bible, and I just threw it in my drawer, and I never got it back out until Pat told me it was still in there, and I got it. And I was amazed at not 1 Corinthians 13 chapter, which is amazing. Nothing religious at all. And you're not asked to do anything that you can't validate in this lifetime. Practice love in your life, and you will validate love in your life. They're not saying will yourself to assent to something that you can't prove. They're doing what we do in AA, and that is, this is what I did, why don't you try that and see how it works for you? And that's, anyway. So, I remember, not that I overdo things, but as Bob acknowledged last night, I am relentless. But in being relentless, my life has gotten relentlessly better. And so I remain relentless. It can always get more better, but or betterer. So I was in the corner again. I was in the corner, and I'm reading chapter 7 in the 12 and 12. I want to interject this now. I should have mentioned it earlier. I planned to. After a year of planning, you thought that I would have gotten that, but no, now. In 1984, there was a book published through our publishing company called Pass It On, Bill W., Pass It On. So by the end of 1985, when I had 13 years of sobriety, I read on page 352 to 354, in Pass It On, where it said Bill had 15 years to watch people come into Alcoholics Anonymous, work the steps from the big book, remain sober, but remain angry, anxious, depressed, and filled with dread about the circumstances and events of their life, long after the high tide of active alcoholism has receded. And he decided to write essays on the 12 steps to be included with essays on the 12 traditions. And he wrote a letter to Father Dowling, which I wish he would have put into the preface of the 12 and 12, where he said, my goal was not to change the steps at all. My goal was to broaden and deepen the experience of the old-timer and newcomer alike with their experience of the steps. And as I mentioned earlier, the big book tells us a lot about when we should pray and meditate. And other than giving us the prayers, which sometimes is God, if there is a God, he tells us more about how to meditate and pray in the 12 and 12. And I am now, just because that's what I've decided to do with my life, is just keep going through the steps. I have discovered that if I go through the steps and just try to maintain what I have gotten, then I lose, things get different, and then I've got to start the steps over again. So what the hell, I just keep doing them and keep doing them in a different way. And now I do the first step, for example, from the big book, then finish the first step in the 12 and 12. And now I'm reading a book called A New Pair of Glasses by one of my AA heroes, Chuck C. And I am looking there not for how to do the steps, but for how to have God in my life, what my goal is. Chuck said in the second chapter, the beginning of the second chapter, if you paid attention to my talk last night, this morning, you know that we have a living problem. And the living problem requires a living answer. And in my opinion, neither the non-alcoholic or the alcoholic alike can find this living answer unless they have found a personally satisfactory, conscious partnership with the God that made them in this entire business of living. That would be probably over 90% of the stuff in our entire, don't leave a hell of a lot out. And if I can decide in the morning, whatever's happening today is personally satisfactory with me, and I will endeavor to be conscious of your presence through the day. Stop when agitated or doubtful and get recentered. If I do that, then my life is relentlessly better than when I don't do that. So that's what I'm working on. I meditate every day. I asked Daryl to read that. Okay, my life was going good. And in 1991, now, I started meditating every day with 30 minutes of meditation on the 1st of October, 1974. And I meditated for 30 minutes, and some of us think that 5 minutes is a long time at the Marina Center, but 30 minutes every day, and I was going to do it every day for the rest of my life, and I made it until January of 2002, when I had open heart surgery, and I skipped a day, and I'm telling you, if you skip a day, it's a mistake. I don't give a damn how loaded you are on painkillers or what the hell. Stay right in there. Bob sponsored, he wasn't my sponsor then, but when I was telling him after the surgery that I was having trouble getting back into the 11th step, he just as a throwaway line said, well, that's the 11th step. Why don't you start with step one and work your way back? You know, and that was a big, big help. But in 91, I retired as the manager of the systems engineering department in the helicopter design division on the Apache helicopter. Now life is stress-free. And I can skip this part where it's been agitated or doubtful. I skip that. And then pretty soon I'm hitting the damn snooze alarm again. Now I didn't stop meditating, but upon awakening, you see, I just do not do that. Do not rest on laurels, because let me tell you, we have no laurels. God has laurels. And when you rest on your laurels, you're resting on zero. That's, you know, now you could not have, hell, I've read that, I've heard that all the time I've been sober, but I did it, and I would have sworn that I wasn't, you know. And then, in June of, well, before that, but we had some people, Pat and I owned a very, very, we owned a comedy club, or we were owners, had partners, but, and it was not only a great life where you can go in every week and find out that every problem that you had last week is a goddamn joke. A gosh darn joke. But if you're going to the comedy club, get ready for something worse than that. Life was so good, and these people, we had the best market, and some people wanted, young guys were willing to give up taking a profit now in order to build the business up later so we could sell it to the big boys. That was a 10-year plan. I'm 75. You know how much interest I have in 10-year plans? Very little. You know how much interest I have in not taking dividends out of profits? Less than anything. And so as it ended up, Walmart moved to town. Walmart of comedy moved to town, and Mom and Pop gave up their store. And I resented. Now I wished that I had continued upon awakening, on planning my day, when facing indecision, when agitated or doubtful. As I go through the day, remind myself that I'm no longer running the show. You know, that is essential stuff for a sober life of relentlessly improving wellness. And included in that is, in my morning meditation, I spend at least enough time, and have for a long time. I memorized 1 Corinthians 13 chapter, And I'm telling you, I went over that without my mind wandering. If it wandered, I had to start over again. Well, you start, and you can't lie to yourself. And that became part of my day. And I got to the place where I could go through the first three parts and then go back to the second part. Love suffereth long and is kind. Love envieth not. Love vaunteth not itself, is not puffed up. Does not behave itself unseemly. Seeketh not her own, is not easily provoked. Thinketh no evil, and rejoices not in iniquity, but rejoices in truth. Which Drummond says, if you love your life, you will be patient. What the hell's not to be patient for if you love your life? If you're loving your life, you don't care what color the light is, you're loving your life. If it turns green and they just sit there, you don't care. That's called patience. It's also called loving your life. Same way with kindness. If you can show some kindness to Kent, do it now because we may not pass this way again. And we live our life, if we love our life, we will live our life that way. Now, I got where that was a more active part in my life. And I gave it up when you give up morning upon arising, you see. Now, pretty soon, the law of probable dispersal manifests itself. That's a technical term, Bob. What it means is whatever hits the fan will never be distributed evenly. It's also known as the why does it all land on me law. Well, once that happens, and it always happens, and you don't have your guard up, I want to just say my experience is don't give this stuff up. It is too good in our lives and too hard to get back. You got to kind of start over again. Start over again. And starting over again isn't bad if you don't have so damn far to go up as you did have. You know, so anyway, this is a tremendous thing that we have been given. I was driving to work, and this guy cut me off. Just barely missed my left front fender in order to hit the off-ramp. And I thought, I have done that to people, and I didn't mean to cut them off, and he didn't mean to cut me off either. Can you believe that? I didn't try to make that happen. That just became a way of living my life. I felt good. The light changed. The guy just sat there. And the boy said, Clancy told me, he said, I'd used this story before in his presence, and afterwards he said, I want you to know, he said, that's a good talk, Howard. And it was a good talk. But I want you to know two things. When we talk to God, we call that prayer. And when God talks to us, we call that schizophrenia. There's a lot of truth in that, you know. But the voice said, I don't care, it sounded like a voice. It may have just been a thought. But it sounded to me like a voice. And the voice says, you really feel good now, don't you, Howard? Yes, I do. Would you give that up because the color of a light changed? How profound is that? As a thought from me. Not likely from me. Must have come from my schizophrenia. So, I, no question, everybody up here, everybody here knows this thing works. The steps are an obvious essential feature of that. The traditions are obviously, because when we, as Clancy was sharing last night, when we get away from the traditions, we get into problems, you know? And we were trained in our lives, we were trained to win the competition. Who are you competing with? Everybody for everything. From when you're in the first grade, you're graded on a curve. An uneven damn thing. Roger Bruton was 20 times smarter than I am. And he didn't have as far to go as I did. That's what he ought to grade it. How far do you have to go? but we're in this competition. And we come to AA and it says, we're not organized for authority. We're organized to be of service. Our leaders probably elsewhere in life. Leaders are leaders, but the leaders here are of service. They do not govern. This is a whole new different life that we're given here to take into our culture. So as Chuck C. says, we can see how I can be of service to you. How can I provide you with the best dinner? The best service, the best entertainment. And if I focus on that, I am rewarded every day. If I focus on dividends, I get them once every quarter. I focused on dividends. You know, I'd be going along good, and then all at once I'm worried about the damn dividend check. And I got to bring the program. I got to take the program back into my life. Prayer and meditation is my hub for doing that. That all the steps are there to get us there. Reading the book on meditation, it says whatever way you find God, that is the right way. Okay? I found God in science, and I found God in meditation. I was meditating, and I kept thinking, why in the hell do I have to do this? My boss don't do this. Why do I have to do this? And then I saw a frozen lake. I don't know why I'm seeing a frozen lake, but I'm seeing a frozen lake. And I know the ice on that lake is as thick as the laws of physics will allow ice to get. And it's my fantasy, it's my meditation, so I know that. And the thought comes to me, you could put a Sherman tank on that ice and it would support it. And then the voice said, that's right, Howard. And walking across the lake a step at a time is a good metaphor for living your life a day at a time. If you're not convinced that the ice is thick enough to support you, you will dread every step you take. And if you're not convinced your life a day at a time is supported in every way for you to fulfill your purpose in life, you will dread every day or parts of every day. So I could back out of that meditation and believing and working harder to believe that I have a personally satisfactory, conscious partnership with this God that created me in this entire business of living. Whatever way you find God, that's the right way for you. If you think Him out intellectually and you're convinced of God's presence, that's right for you. Or if you just sense His presence, that's right for you. But remember, wherever you see God pass, mark that spot and go sit in that window again. Alcoholics Anonymous is my window. these meetings. This is where I come to see God pass. Thank you very much for letting me come.